This free podcast is brought to you by our GoDaddy coupon page at scottsigler.com/GoDaddy. Consider sharing this page and the coupons on it with anyone you know who makes websites, who needs a website, who runs a small business, anyone with kids, because parents should absolutely lock up their kids' firstlastname.com, if at all possible, before someone else does. The code CJCSIG99C, that's CJCSIG99C, locks up a new .com for just 99 cents. That is 93% off the regular price. Share that code and any others you find at scottsigler.com/GoDaddy with friends, with fam, on coupon sites, etc. Now, maybe you don't need a .com, but we here at Empty Set have often dealt with the scumbags that register every name they can come up with, and then they want to extort money for those domains from the people who would actually use those sites as a business or in their creative works. So share the codes and the page wherever you can, that CJCSIG99C and scottsigler.com/GoDaddy, and now on with our story. Welcome to the serialized audiobook, Earthcore. Written by New York Times best-selling novelist Scott Sigler. Narrated by Ray Porter. Produced by Steve Rickyberg. Earthcore is also available in print as an ebook and as a full-length audiobook. If you want the whole story without waiting, grab one of these formats from the links at scottsigler.com/earthcore. Hello, junkies! I pre-recorded this episode well ahead of time, 1 week ahead of time, actually. Why? Because we are currently at Siglerfest 2K18, sucker! We are in Las Vegas for the endless positivity, mirth, and frothy beverages that comprise our annual gathering of goodness. It's kind of like the gathering of the Juggalos, but with less face paint and more knowledge of how magnets work. As this episode releases, Ariel Girl and I and all the junkies are probably hungover, sitting in a Vegas casino lounge, watching the NFL with a bunch of junkies dressed up in their various NFL garb rooting on their teams, and we're all commiserating with each other, hopefully eating a nice greasy breakfast and watching football. Also, if you ordered anything recently, know that, of course, it hasn't shipped yet because we are in Vegas, but we will get to the shipping as soon as we can when we return to sunny, wonderful paradise, San Diego, California. So let's get you all caught up on the story so far, and then we're going to go cut a rap record. Previously on Earthcore. The company miners, led by Mac Hendricks, are finally ready to explore the caves, but small, unexplained ground tremors threaten lethal danger to anyone who enters. With Angus Gould and Randy Wright, the victims of lab sabotage, can Katarina Hayes find the source of these tremors before it's too late? And that's not her only problem. Hayes is trying to find the reason for an inexplicable, miles-long line that runs across the mountain and goes so far down they can't even measure the depth. What caused this line? What does this line mean? Find out next on Earthcore, episode number 16.
AM. Katarina didn't miss her family as much as she had figured. She simply didn't have time to think about them. She sat at a small desk that belonged to Angus, trying to cope with the pressure bearing down on her from all sides.
"It's been 48 fucking hours, Ahmed," she said. "You're no closer to figuring out the cause of that aberrant spike. We have to figure this out. There are people in that shaft."
"And Kirkland will have my head if I go back to him with yet another shoulder shrug," was how the sentence should have ended.
Ahmed glared at her. She realized, and not for the first time in the last 2 days, that he was glaring at her the same way he used to glare at Angus. It hurt her to ride Ahmed like this, but she needed answers.
"I can't see through solid rock," he said. "How am I supposed to find out what it is? The damn computer keeps cutting out every 6 hours. How can you expect results with work conditions like this?
She slapped the desktop.
No more excuses. No one is going to die on my watch. If the computer is giving you shit and you can't solve the problem until it works, then start by fixing the goddamn computer. I've got other problems and don't have time to babysit you.
She could hardly believe those words were coming out of her mouth, but they were, and she meant them. Being in charge wasn't exactly the dream job she'd envisioned. Ahmed's face screwed tight with anger.
I need help, he said. You've taken the rest of the staff to help you study that meaningless line. If you want me to solve the problem, give me more resources.
Maybe he was right about that.
Take Mitchell, she said. And Rodriguez, get it fixed.
He walked away, already shouting for those two to join him at the main computer. Ahmed had checked the spikes against Mac's blasting record. They hadn't been caused by any Earth Core activity. She feared the spikes meant cave-ins, somewhere in the natural tunnels, something that would slow the project down and make Kirkland very unhappy. She returned to her work. Ahmed had one mystery, she had another. In addition to the seismic spikes, Kirkland wanted to know the cause of the strange line Dr. Reeves had detected. Katerina had assigned every free person to mapping that line, and the results were shocking. 4 miles downhill and a half mile uphill from where Reeves and Hack had found the phenomenon, the line broke off into two lines that each took a 90-degree turn south. Both of those new lines reached south for 3.28 miles. At that point, both took a 90-degree turn toward each other, making a new line, a line that completed a rectangle, a 4.652-mile-long and 3.28-mile-wide rectangle, in which the mine shaft sat almost dead center. They had taken to calling it the Reeves Rectangle. Who made it? Why? And how on earth did they do it? Katerina didn't have any answers. She shuddered. Connell wouldn't like that. Wouldn't like that at all. 11:52 a.m. Mac and every miner on staff, even the morning shift, sat on folding chairs in the security staff's Quonset. They watched in rapt attention as O'Doyle held up a bright yellow form-fitting jumpsuit. The suit supposedly would allow them to safely explore the caves.
"This is a cool suit,"
O'Doyle said, his voice bellowing like a drill sergeant's.
"That's cool with a K, as in its inventor, Angus Cool. The fabric is a microtubule material that accommodates the flow of coolant throughout the suit. This small backpack unit circulates fluid through the material to regulate your body temperature."
The morning shift miners looked beat, drained by the heat, all except for Jansen and Sherwood, who watched O'Doyle's every move and seemed locked in on his every word. They'd quietly asked if they could pull a double shift and go down with Mac. He wasn't crazy about the idea, but the two men were both experienced climbers. Having them along might help identify the safest path, help reach the dense mass faster. O'Doyle gripped the suit in both hands and tried to pull it apart. The man's muscles bulged and twitched. O'Doyle had an old man's gut but a young man's arms. There was no doubt he was trying his best to rip the suit. The suit stretched slightly but refused to break.
"The material itself is very durable," he said. "Cool suits are also coated with a layer of Kevlar, so they should hold up well while you're crawling through the tunnels. However, be aware of the dangerous environment. We expect the temperature to exceed 200 degrees Fahrenheit, which means that if your suit rips in any way, repair it immediately with the patches stored in your backpack. Then alert your supervisor and head for the surface as fast as possible."
Mac raised his hand. O'Doyle nodded at him.
"That means no tough guy stuff," Mac said, turning slowly to address all the miners. "Safety first, always. Any tear, no matter how small, and you get back to the surface. If I see anyone with a tear that they haven't reported, you are automatically fired. No second chances, no excuses. Understand?"
Heads nodded. Mac gestured for O'Doyle to continue.
"Mr. Hendricks threatens you with unemployment," O'Doyle said. "I'll threaten you with your life. Mr. Takachi here has been a combat medic and understands what happens to the human body in dire situations. Mr. Takachi.
Cho Takachi stood up. He pushed his sunglasses up a sweat-sheened nose.
At the temperatures we expect, any problem could prove fatal, he said. Without a functioning suit, you will dehydrate and die in a matter of hours. Do not, I repeat, do not remove your gloves to touch anything. Not under any circumstances. The rocks in the lower tunnel are hot enough to cause second-degree burns on contact.
He sat. O'Doyle set the suit down on a table. He picked up a pair of yellow gloves.
The most important parts of your suit are the gloves and the flexi mask. That is why your suit pockets contain a spare pair of gloves and a spare mask. If a glove tears, undo the wrist seal, remove it, put on the replacement, and make sure the wrist seal locks tight.
He set the gloves down and picked up what looked like a flimsy piece of plastic wrap, the flexi mask. He spread it out across his palms and pressed it to his face. It seemed to conform to him, almost to hug his cheeks and chin, eyes and forehead. He lowered his hands. His face looked a little duller, but other than that, he might have had nothing on at all.
As you can see, the mask covers my face but doesn't block my mouth or nose. Air that would cook you from the inside out is lowered to breathable temperatures. Do not ask me to explain the tech because I do not understand it. What I know is you get the benefit of not having to wear a rebreather, and trust me, that is a good thing. The cool suit hoods cover your head, neck, and ears. This mask covers the rest and automatically locks in with the hood's material. Mr. Hendricks, if you would be so kind as to let me guide you through putting on the suit while everyone watches?
I'd love to, mate.
He stood in front of the men, had no shame stripping down to his boxers, while some of the miners hooted and made jokes, all in good fun. Mac did everything as O'Doyle told him to do, obeying every deep-voiced order to the letter. Mac wanted his people to be safe, of course, but O'Doyle also had a tone of command that could not easily be ignored. As Mac donned the rubbery cool suit, careful to make sure every seal was secure, excitement began to wash over him. They had built the camp. They had drilled the shaft. They had blasted their way to the tunnel complex. Now, he was preparing for the final step, to explore an area untouched by man. Granted, it was going to be mostly tight tunnels, nothing more to see than limestone walls eroded by millions of years of circulating water. But that feeling of discovery pumped adrenaline through his blood. The suit felt cool against his skin, effortlessly chasing away the midday heat. He barely felt the mask, but sensed the air that he breathed was cooler. He felt something hard in the seat. Must be some padding in case people had to sit down on rocks.
"Fits great," he said. "A bit heavier than I thought, though."
O'Doyle took his right wrist, held it up for all to see.
"There is a built-in display woven right into the fabric," he said. "External temp, body temp, a clock with timers, air quality measurements. It's all right there for you."
Jansen raised a hand. O'Doyle nodded at him.
"Pardon me for asking," Jansen said. "But I don't see a fly in those pants. How do we pee?"
O'Doyle pointed at Mac's crotch. Mac suddenly felt a bit uncomfortable.
"Inside your pants is a flexible tube," O'Doyle said. "Similar to the Fleximask. Place your penis in the tube and leave it there. Women have a different fitting. You'll know if you get the wrong suit. I chose not to help Mr. Hendricks with his tube, as we're not even on a first-name basis yet. Trust me, men, you do not want to be whipping out your tallywhacker in air that's 200 degrees. Earth Corps' healthcare plan will not cover the subsequent sex change requests."
The miners laughed.
"If the suit feels a bit heavy, that's because it carries a gallon of water," O'Doyle said. "If you carried water in an external container, it would wind up being the same temperature as the hot air, which means it would boil away. Bad news. There's bladders throughout the material, so the water in the suit is kept cool by the suit. There's a drinking tube in the neck that slides right up inside the mask. Seeing as hydration is so important, the suit will filter your urine and add that water back to the mix."
The men groaned in disgust. O'Doyle held up a hand to silence them.
"And now let's have a serious talk about poop."
He grabbed Mac's shoulders, spun him around to show his backside to the miners. O'Doyle made a fist, wrapped his knuckles against the hard pad in the seat of Mac's suit.
"So that you don't burn your precious little bungholes, Dr. Cool included a built-in feces processor," O'Doyle said. "Just squat and go. The suit will take your turds and put them through the world's smallest little airlock. Believe it or not, man, this suit will even clean up any fecal detritus left on your rectum. In other words, this is the closest I've ever been to being so rich I can afford to have someone else wipe my ass for me. The men laughed again. Mac, though, did not. It hadn't crossed his mind, but it made sense. It could get so hot down there that taking down your pants to take a shit might cause skin burns. The fun was over. Time to get going.
All right, men, he said. Mr. O'Doyle and Mr. Takachi will help you suit up. 13 of us need to be dressed and on that elevator as soon as possible.
12:21 p.m. Patrick O'Doyle could have crushed Connell Kirkland in a heartbeat. Both men knew it. Physical prowess, however, had little to do with their relationship.
Two cool suits missing, Connell said.
Patrick nodded once.
Yes, sir.
Connell stared. It was a stare worthy of a CO in any forward combat area, a stare that said, I'm having a hard time processing what a stupid, worthless fuck you are. I trusted you and you let me down. Patrick had delivered an identical stare many times in his life. As far as the stare went, it was always better to give than to receive. Patrick was usually the giver. He was on the receiving end this time, though, and he deserved every miserable, skin-crawling second of it. 8 years in the Marines had taught him that authority was something you followed without question. 8 years, multiple tours, and multiple combat engagements had riveted that rule into his soul to the point where it was never forgotten, never unlearned. The Marines had also drilled home one more concept. There is no excuse for failure.
Two cool suits missing, Connell said again. When did you find out? This morning, as Mr. Hendricks prepared to take the first crew into the tunnels. There are 26 suits, enough for two full 13-man mining crews. We counted off the 13 that outfit the men currently in the tunnels with Mr. Hendricks. After the training session, we did a count on the remaining suits and discovered two were unaccounted for. Unaccounted for. Is that some kind of bullshit military speak for, I have no idea how to do my job?
Patrick winced.
I'm afraid that's exactly what it means, Mr. Kirkland.
No beating around the bush, no excuses. The buck stopped here.
Connell was a good boss. A demanding boss who told you exactly what he wanted, then let you figure out how to get that job done on your own.
Need resources? He provided them. Needed ideas? He gave them. He was fair, but he also expected success in all things. If you didn't get the job done, it was your fault and no one else's. It wasn't just failure. It was failing him, failing Connell Kirkland, the man who had basically saved Patrick's life. 2 years earlier, Patrick had been jobless, let go after 21 years of service to his country. 21 years, his entire adult life. Jobless, damn near homeless. Unless you counted living in a flophouse as homeless, in which case he was that too. He'd been forgotten. He'd had nothing. He'd had no one. All that service, all that pain and sacrifice, and no one seemed to give a fuck about him. He wasn't good for killing anymore, so why bother? They had used him up, then discarded him. He'd grown up an orphan, never really knew his parents, foster homes, growing too big, too soon, with too much anger. Nobody could handle him. School wasn't his thing. Sports gave some outlet, wrestling in particular, but he didn't have the discipline needed to excel. Graduated, but barely. No prospects for a kid with little education, no connections, no family. So, he'd taken the only route possible for many teenagers just like him. He'd enlisted. The Marines gave him the discipline he needed, and as far as anger outlets went, hard to beat hand-to-hand combat training, learning to shoot, burning off all the energy he had, and then some. He'd grown up with nothing, but in the service he found his true calling. Then came deployment. The service changes a man. So does real combat. Killing. Seeing people you know get killed. The brutality of war. Of trying to do your job and also stay alive at the same time. Three deployments. 27 confirmed kills. Taking life bothered some of his fellow Marines. Affected them at a deep level. It didn't bother Patrick. At all. He didn't know what that said about him as a person, and he didn't really care. He was good at it. He was praised for it, rewarded for it. At 8 years in, he was ready to re-up for a third hitch, work toward his 20, when his CO had sent him to Washington, D.C., to meet with a man named Murray Longworth. What Longworth had to say didn't surprise Patrick. Sometimes, higher-ups in government needed specific things done, things that no one could know about, things that would never be reported on or recorded in any way. They called it gray work. Turned out Patrick was good at that, too. Patrick O'Doyle became a non-person. Longworth's people erased his past, removed all military records, fingerprints, dental records, anything that could tie his corpse, should he die while on mission, to the U.S. government. He spent a decade traveling the world, killing who they told him to kill. He specialized in jungle work and urban penetration. On 3 separate occasions, Murray had asked Patrick to volunteer for missions instead of ordering him to go, because it was unlikely the operator would be able to escape after the target was hit. Patrick accepted all 3, and all 3 times, he made it back. The last of those missions, though, had ended badly. He'd been caught, tortured. His captors had burned off his ear. Had he talked? He didn't remember. All he knew was that he'd gotten very lucky. A drone strike had hit the compound where he was being held, caused enough damage and chaos that he'd escaped. Scarred, disfigured, he stood out now, couldn't blend in. Murray couldn't use him for gray missions anymore. Too bad, so sad, Patrick, but you're no longer on the starting squad. Murray had found work for him in the Department of Special Threats, a mostly off-the-books agency that handled crazy bioterror shit. The things Patrick had seen there. Belize, Saskatchewan, Black Manitou Island, a parade of death. Then the budget cuts. Patrick O'Doyle and his 21 years of service were no longer needed. Thank you very much. Here's a pin and a ribbon. Move on. Those 11 years you spent traveling the globe to wipe out the enemies of democracy, yeah, those don't count toward your retirement. Have a nice life. Your grateful nation really appreciates your service, just not in a way that will pay the bills. He had found himself without direction for the first time since he'd turned 18. Skills such as avoiding local police, jungle survival, and how to kill a man from a mile away didn't translate into the civilian world. There were no missions, no commanding officers, no orders. He'd had no one to tell him what to do. He'd felt lost. What did he do for a living? Bagged groceries, mopped floors, made barely enough to pay for food and a rent-by-the-month hotel. The indignity of it all. He'd been a soldier, a leader of men, a prized asset. From all that to nothing. A scarred, ugly, lonely, nobody. Every day, eating a bullet seemed more and more like the only way out. Then that woman had found him. So strange. A knockout blonde shows up at the flophouse. Perfect body, perfect face, eyes as soulless as black marbles. She had a plane ticket. Did he want work? Real work? Fly to Denver to meet with Connell Kirkland. Patrick had. The interview lasted about 15 minutes. Connell hired him on the spot. Big salary. Big responsibility. For the first time in his life, Patrick held a job where the paycheck didn't come from Uncle Sam. Structure and purpose. That's what Connell had given him. And pride. Patrick belonged again. He had a responsibility. Connell didn't care about his past, his scarring, didn't care about anything other than seeing that his company and his personnel were properly protected. This man, this lanky, tall man with the dead gray eyes, he had given Patrick his life back and a future, a retirement plan, percentages, all that, and he'd let Connell down. "Those suits are expensive," Connell said. His voice remained distant, detached. "Do you have any idea of how much each suit is worth?" "Yes, sir, Mr. Kirkland," O'Doyle snapped off the word sir, crisp and loud, exactly as he would have done were he still in the service.
Each suit is worth $35,230 American.
Connell nodded.
Very good. As if the price wasn't enough to piss me off, there's the small fact that we're on the side of a mountain in the middle of a fucking desert. I know you well enough to assume that you accounted for all the suits both when we left and when we arrived, am I correct?
Yes, sir.
As a security chief, you seem to be very good at misplacing things in the middle of a fucking desert, don't you?
Yes, sir.
The air conditioner's hum and the slow thump of Connell's fingers drumming on the desktop. Ba-da-ba-bump, ba-da-ba-bump were the only sounds in the trailer. O'Doyle thought Connell looked like a grenade with the pin pulled, ready to explode at any second.
And the lab accident, he said. Tell me again what you found.
Patrick had already told him, twice. When you were a failure, Connell liked to make you repeat things.
A pressure valve may have been tampered with. Looks like something hit it. Could have happened a week ago, could have happened today. That probably let static electricity get into the tank. The tank blew.
Ba-da-ba-bump. Ba-da-ba-bump.
That happened 2 days ago, Connell said. And you're no closer to finding out who did it?
Patrick felt his jaw clenching, his teeth grinding. If he'd been closer to finding out, he would have said so, and Connell knew that. In many ways, this calm-voiced repetition was far worse than being screamed at.
No, sir. I found nothing else.
Then look harder. Now get out of my sight.
Patrick left. So humiliating. Someone was getting the better of him. Someone was making him look like a fool. Someone was making him angry. He knew he wasn't the smartest man that ever walked the earth, but he was one of the most tireless and dedicated. Sooner or later, he'd find the truth. He'd find the bastard responsible. When that happened, he planned on carving Semper Fidelis into the fuckwad's chest. 12:40 p.m. Two missing cool suits. Two injured scientists. Sabotage. No, not just sabotage. Expert sabotage. As if someone knew the equipment inside and out.
They wouldn't,
Connell whispered. He picked up his cell phone, dialed.
Milford Valley Memorial Hospital?
A woman answered.
Angus Cool's room, please.
There was a pause as the woman transferred the call. The phone rang five times before someone answered.
Hello?
Angus?
No, this is Randy.
Connell here. Let me talk to Angus.
He's sleeping,
Randy said.
So wake him up.
The doctor doesn't want him disturbed, Randy said. He's still feeling a lot of head pain.
Randy wanted to protect Angus. That's what friends did for one another. Well and fine, but he was picking the wrong time to exhibit his misguided loyalties.
I don't care if his brains are dripping out of his ears. Wake him up right fucking now.
Fine, hold on a second.
After a brief pause, the phone rustled as it switched hands.
Mr. Kirkland, what's up?
Said a sleepy Angus.
How are you doing, Angus?
I was sleeping, that's how I was doing. What do you need?
Could he be up to something?
Just wanted to check up on you guys.
Golly, Dad, thanks a bunch, but me and the gang aren't going anywhere.
Fine, Connell said. Sorry to wake you.
Angus hung up without another word. He and Randy were exactly where they were supposed to be. If they were, who had stolen the suits? Who had sabotaged the lab? And how were they getting in and out of camp so easily? Connell knew the answer. Someone in the camp was on the take. Someone was getting paid off. If he didn't get his people to the dense mass soon, that someone else would beat him to it. And then all of this would be for nothing. No matter what the cost, Mac Hendricks had to move faster. 12:47 p.m.
Slow down, Jansen, Keith Sherwood called out. You're descending too fast.
Brian Jansen looked up from his slightly swinging line, his light playing up the chasm and flashing brightly in Keith's eyes. Jansen dangled in a sea of black, like a yellow worm on a hook.
"I'll be sure to be careful, Mommy," he said. "Been climbing since before you were a single cell of annoying tickling the inside of your daddy's nutsack. I think I know what I'm doing."
"Asshole," Keith murmured under his breath. He didn't want to be in this sliver of a tunnel. Rough limestone walls pressed against his body on every side. The suit kept him cool, but he felt the heat on his face, on his eyes. There was no turning around here. To get out, you either crawled backward for 30 feet or descended into the chasm. Keith panned his headlamp on a plastic-coated map. Mac had sent them here. According to the map, several thin tunnels branched off the chasm floor 150 feet below. The steep vertical drop might provide a shortcut to the dense mass, so it had to be explored.
"Almost to the bottom," Jansen called up.
Keith again looked down into the chasm, only his head peeking over the edge. Jansen was farther down now, the equivalent of 14 or 15 stories. He looked like a wriggling yellow toy soldier.
"Seems okay,"
Jansen said, voice echoing off the dark chasm walls.
"Jagged rocks, poor footing, but it looks okay. I'll..."
A cry of pain, a muffled, brittle snap that echoed up just as his voice had. Keith's light reached down. Far below, Jansen lay on his side. So far away, so small.
"Jansen, you okay?"
A pause.
"Fine," Jansen said, forcing out the word. "If you don't count my broken leg."
Keith felt a new stab of fear. This dark place, so far below the surface, and without Jansen, he would be alone.
"Quit fucking around, man."
"Wish I was," Jansen said. "My foot slipped on this boulder. Leg's broken. Left arm might be dislocated, too. Mac's going to kill me."
"Hold on, I'll tie a new line and come get you."
Keith felt at the chasm edge, hands searching for the best way over.
"Don't be an idiot," Jansen said. "You know procedure. If you have rope problems, we're both stuck here. You can't pull me up by yourself. Go back and get Mac. Get help."
Crawling backward through this tunnel. No one with him.
"You're crazy," Keith said. "I can't leave you here."
Jansen laughed, a sound choked off by a grunt of pain.
"God damn, maybe a rib too," he said. "Just go, kid. It'll take you maybe 20 minutes to crawl back to the others, so I'm looking at an hour all by my lonesome. The sooner you start, the sooner I'm out of here. Until then, about all I can do is whack off. Good thing I hurt my left arm and not my right, eh?"
An hour down there on his own. His batteries would last that long, easy, so he wouldn't be in the dark. Just the thought of it made Keith's skin crawl.
"What about your suit? Any rips?"
Far below, the yellow toy soldier felt at his legs, grunted as his good hand searched around.
"I think it's okay. Fuck, this hurts. Would you go get somebody?"
"Okay, just hold tight."
Keith closed his eyes, tried to focus. He couldn't think about himself. Every minute he waited was another minute his friend would be in agony. He took a deep breath, then pushed away from the chasm's edge. In minutes, all sound of Keith's efforts faded away. Jansen was truly alone. He gritted his teeth against the pain, pushed himself to a sitting position. It hurt, sure, but he'd felt worse. What was this, the third time he'd broken his leg? The fourth? Just be cool, sit and wait. Help would be there before he knew it. He sat still, ears instinctively hunting for sounds, finding none. He hated the quiet, and caves were dead quiet. Not a sound at all other than your own. You didn't notice how noisy the world around you was until you came to a place like this. No wind, no creaks, no squeaks, no honks. Nothing. A weird feeling, like someone had grabbed nature's remote control and hit mute. Damn fool thing to get in a hurry and break a leg. He should have been more... A sound. Something small. Echoing. Click, click. Click. Metal on rock? He flashed his light upward toward the tunnel mouth 150 feet above. Nothing moved. He waited for the sound to come again, but only silence met his ears. He looked around the chasm bottom, his headlamp following his gaze. Several tunnels, but all very small, probably too small to crawl through. The trip was a waste of... Another sound. Different. Coming from one of the tunnels leading out from the chasm floor. A hiss. A rattling whisper. The sound of dry, rustling leaves sliding across open pavement.
That's it for Earthcore episode number 16. The sound of rustling leaves. Well, I think we heard that sound earlier in the book. Want to find out what happens to Jansen next? Then tune in next week for episode number 17 of Earthcore. And until then, we will talk to you all real soon. You have been listening to Earthcore, written by Scott Sigler, read by Ray Porter, produced by Steve Rickyberg. Copyright 2017 by Empty Set Entertainment. All rights reserved. Theme music is by the band Amps and Volts.